Hi, peace be upon you all. Thank you all for so much for being here tonight. My name is Anwar Omish. I'm a junior here at Harvard. I'm the Director of External Relations for the Harvard Islamic Society, as well as the head of our Anti-Islamophobia Network, which is a student group that partners with community organizations to work on issues that target Muslim communities. I also want to thank my other organizers, the National Lawyers Guild here in Massachusetts, the Jewish Voice for Peace in Boston, CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, Massachusetts, as well as the Muslim Justice League. I also want to thank the rest of the co-sponsors, and there are way too many to read, but if you're here in the room, thank you all so much. I want to start by saying that this event and these issues are really difficult and really personal for me. Just last week, I was having a conversation with my mom about applying for a visa for my grandfather, who has only visited the United States once and who lives in Libya, and we were talking about getting that visa process completed before something new happened. And then yesterday, I found out that I might never see my grandfather again. I don't know if he's going to be able to make it to my graduation in a year and a half. He wasn't able to make it to my sister's graduation last year, and she was his first grandchild. The grandchild of two people who didn't complete their education was graduating from Yale, and they weren't able to be there. So I don't know. I don't know when I'm going to see him, and it's that kind of uncertainty that these sorts of policies are creating. And it's that difficulty that we are facing today. My family is not the first family to be separated by unjust policies. It's not going to be the last. The Muslim ban is not the only one of those policies that is tearing apart families and harming members of our community, which is why it's important for us all to be here and to be talking about these things. But also it's important for us all to be at these events, but not just stop at being at these events. To be at these events and then think about how we can come together to generate solutions and to think about how to pressure those in office and those who are making these policies while centering the voices of those most affected in order to be able to create the communities that we all believe in. So we're very excited to have you here, not only to learn more about the history, where these things are coming from, because as I'm sure many of us in this room recognize, we can't really separate Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism from other structures in this country, from racism, from anti-blackness, from militarism, and from all of the other sort of ills that have plagued us for ever and a half, since before the founding of this country. And sort of on that vein, I do want to recognize that we are on native land, Wampanoag and Mashpee land, and I go to school on this land. But anyway, so thank you all for being here. I'm hoping that these conversations, again, connecting the history to the legal situation today, and finally to what we can do about these things and sort of concrete actions on the local level and the national level, that in that we'll be able to come together and commit to creating change and building those communities that I know we all believe in. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce our first speaker. We're going to have five speakers today. It's a very exciting evening. But I do want to introduce our first speaker, who is Aisha Kazmi. She's a community organizer at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center in Roxbury, where she organizes service projects on issues such as affordable housing. She's also a community education advisor to the Muslim Justice League, where she contributes her expertise on Muslim civil rights issues under the War on Terror. Her knowledge in this area has been obtained from working as a researcher and analyst for CAGE UK, which works on terror policies in the United Kingdom. Aisha has had various articles published, including reports on British stop and search laws and cyber terrorism. Her research and expertise has been featured in outlets such as The Guardian, the BCC, and the New York Review of Books. She currently serves as a fellow at the Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative, Muslim ARC, an organization that is committed to combating racism and promoting racial justice within American Muslim communities. So if you all can join me in welcoming Aisha. You can click also.
Good evening, everyone. How's everyone doing tonight?
Yeah.
Given the news, I know it's a tough evening for a lot of us this evening. So it's also an emotional moment for me as well. So I'm going to do my best to get through this with everyone knowing that I have the comfort of knowing that I have everyone's support in this room. So thank you all for being here. So my name is Aisha Kazmi. I was born and raised in this city, and I currently live in Dorchester with my husband James and my cat Molly. My parents immigrated to Boston in 1969 from Pakistan, just a couple weeks after they got married, actually, and my mom, about 4 months later, followed him. My father was doing his PhD at MIT at the time, and my parents moved to a house in Brookline when I was about 3 years old. And my family at that time would be one of a very small, tiny handful of South Asian families in Brookline. In fact, when I was growing up in Brookline, I attended the Brookline Public Schools, and I was literally one of four or five South Asians at my school, and the other two were my younger brother and my older sister. No joke. So when my sister graduated from eighth grade, like, the demography of South Asians at that school, like, drastically changed. So one of the gifts that my mother brought with her from Pakistan was her hand for cooking, as they say in Pakistan. She has a great hand for cooking. And in fact, in my parents' social circles, my mother was considered it. She was actually known for her cooking. And she devoted a lot of her time cooking for her family, and she entertained a lot, and we had guests over, and she spent a lot of time cooking. So that was something that I remember about her a lot. And in the fact that she was celebrated by her friends and their growing Pakistani community, for me, it meant something a little bit different. Because what happened was that the smell of fried onions and garlic and turmeric and cumin would sort of permeate my clothing and my books and my backpack, and I would go to school kind of smelling like South Asian cooking, which nowadays would be considered exotic, but back then it really sort of made me an outsider, made me be a little bit different. So one of the things that would happen often was that my classmates had this sort of understanding between them that when I was around, they'd all hold their noses and they'd sort of talk under their breath. So it's called the smelly one. And that was sort of their language for me. And I was sort of, that environment was a little bit tough. And being, looking different from everybody was also a challenge in and of itself. Because I look so different from everybody, I frequently got asked, so where are you from? And to that I would generally respond, Brookline or Boston, because that's all I knew at the time. Still all I know, pretty much. And that answer never satisfied people, and they would always push back and say, no, where are you really from? And I would say, like, eventually they could push me enough that I would say, Pakistan. But I'd oftentimes in response, and this would have been like in the early to mid-80s, I'd get this, what's Pakistan? I've never heard of it. So that was a typical response, and that often made me really shy and embarrassed almost to admit that that's where I was from. So one time when I was young, I remember going to visit a friend's house. I think I was in about fourth or fifth grade. And my friend's parents actually brought me over to their house to sort of play or whatever we did back then. And I remember that particular day, my friend's father asked me that sort of custom question, where are you from? And that day, I actually didn't really think twice because I'd become so accustomed to people saying, like, what's Pakistan? Where is that? And I answered him, and he actually knew where it was and knew a little bit about it. And so I got a response that I didn't expect. And that response was a little, he was a bit aghast. And, oh, Pakistan. Oh, geez. And he sort of began with this narrative, I guess you could say, you must be Muslim. Well, at that time he didn't say Muslim, he said Muslim, and he began questioning me along certain lines, like, oh dear, aren't you an angry bunch of people, and what are you going to do to curb violence? Sort of that kind of line of questioning. I don't really obviously remember word for word, but that's along the lines of questions I got. And the ride home, he took me home, he continued that line of questioning, and I remember being young and sort of feeling very uncomfortable by that line of questioning. And I never got invited back, and I wasn't sure whether it was because I didn't get invited back or I just didn't feel comfortable going back. So that was that story. So moving on, I kind of just wanted to turn to all of you for a couple of seconds and for a quick sort of, brainstorm with all of you, and ask folks in the audience to take a moment and think a little bit about when and around sort of what time frame they might think that Islamophobia really kicked off in this country. Can anybody take a guess? You can raise your hands. Yeah.
9/11.
Okay. Any other answers? Yes.
The Iran hostage.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's sort of, anybody else for anything different?
Slave trade.
Right. Who said that? Yeah, who's saying, who said slave trades, who said 1700s? Okay, so that's actually, I'm going to, believe it or not, I'm actually going to bring it back that far. Because oftentimes that sort of, I guess what we conceive of as current modern Islamophobia, we tend to think that it has its origins in 9/11. But I'm actually going to take all of you through a journey, I guess, into our nation's history to sort of discover a little bit about where Islamophobia might have originated from in this country, if you will. And I'm going to ground my presentation by defining Islamophobia. So this is the Gallup definition of Islamophobia. And according to their definition, Islamophobia is the exaggerated fear, hatred, and hostility towards Islam and Muslims that is perpetuated by the negative stereotypes resulting in bias, discrimination, and the marginalization and the exclusion of Muslims from social, political, and civic life. Secondly, I'm going to make the case that the history of Islamophobia in the United States is as old as the United States itself. And what does that mean exactly? Well, that means that Islamophobia, the exaggerated fear and hostility towards Muslims that results in the stereotyping and discriminating against Muslims, can be found in the very origins of our country. To that end, I'm going to highlight the date 1492. And I guess, can anybody take a guess as to what makes the year 1492 significant? Well, yes, but in this instance, I'm actually going to be addressing the fall of Al-Andalus, or actually in this moment, which marked the official end of Muslim rule over Spain. Islam played a major political force in Spain for about 800 years, ending just before the year 1500. And I guess if anybody else can take another guess as to what, you know, why the year 1492 sounds familiar and significant. So, yes, in 1492, Columbus did sail the ocean blue. And even though Spanish settlers colonized what is now South and Central America, Islamic Spain was really very much a part of the consciousness of the Europeans who came and settled this part of the world. And that piece is really, really critical. And the Spaniards, in this instance, those who colonized and settled in the Americas, they brought their concerns and their fears about Islam and Muslims with them when they settled and they built their colonies here. It can even be argued that the rivalry between Christian Europe and the Muslim world existed for centuries before then, throughout Europe and the Mediterranean, as evidenced by the succession of crusades. But for the sake of this presentation, I'm going to stick with the origins of this particular hostility against Islam and Muslims in the United States. So we're going to begin with this date. As Western Europe began colonizing and settling in the Americas, the demand for labor did intensify. And while slavery was already in existence across Europe and the Mediterranean, the transatlantic slave trade kicked up into high gear. Enslaved Africans were brought over to the Americas from West and Central Africa, where many regions were dominated and ruled by Muslims. And while it's difficult to estimate the exact number of Africans captured and enslaved who were Muslim, from those who were not, nevertheless, it's estimated that the number of Muslims shackled and enslaved and brought to the New World were in the millions. In North America alone, it's estimated that Muslims existed in the tens of thousands. So in the late 15th and early 16th century, it saw the Spaniards arrive to the new colonies in droves, and with them a demand for Africans. Initially, the Spanish issued a ban on bringing enslaved Muslims to the New World. Spanish authorities were worried about the control of heresy and purity in the Indian population in the New World. And what does that mean? The Spanish were incredibly concerned about religion, as well as spreading their own new spreading in their own new lands that they were colonizing. So spreading religion, which was Christianity at the time, for the Spaniards. They worried deeply about not allowing these primitive religions, or so they perceived, to spread in the New World. So I'm just going to read this quote, I guess. For those of you, I don't know. I mean, I guess people can see it, but Spanish authorities were worried about the control of heresy and purity in the Indian population in the New World. At first, Spain wanted only to admit Spanish-speaking Christians into the Indies and not raw blacks directly from Africa. But the Spanish abandoned this policy for economic reasons. In 1510, the crown reevaluated its attitude and concluded that the Bozales were at the time primitive, pre-Christian religious states as the New World Indians, and therefore were not in danger of religiously polluting the Indies. Because of the heavy demand for Negroes in the New World, the Spanish were forced to compromise their position on the ban of the bozales. There was one ban on which they did not compromise, however, and that was the ban on Muslims. One of the fears centered on the belief that Islam would spread from the Africans to the Christianized Indians. In 1492, Spain finally defeated a 700-year-old Muslim state in Europe, and some of the Christian Spanish soldiers in the New World had fought against Islam. And it's interesting to note that there were, in fact, deep concerns on the part of colonial slave traders and settlers that were religiously based. In saying this, however, it's not meant to take away from the anti-Black racism that also existed in the toxic, racialized worldview of the transatlantic slave traders. This fact is actually really more or less meant to acknowledge that simultaneously, the settler sense of European supremacy not only included an anti-Black or anti-African racist worldview, but that it also was permeated with religious Christian supremacy. From there, that suspicion or hostility towards Muslim slaves persisted throughout the colonies into North America as more and more Muslim slaves continued to arrive. Muslim communities endured life in North America, and then what became the United States in the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. The lives of Muslim slaves in the early United States were complicated and very, very nuanced. Many were forced to convert to Christianity, although testimony after testimony demonstrates that Muslim slaves begrudgingly converted to Christianity, or often only superficially while remaining internally devoted to Islam and the culture of Islam. Some enslaved Muslims were permitted by their masters to pray 5 times a day openly and professing their faith, while others felt too scared to reveal their Islamic identity, oftentimes taking the names of their owners in order to hide who they were. Nevertheless, and despite the hardship of life living under chattel slavery, it's well documented that early American Muslim communities paid zakat, which is the annual alms that Muslims give. They fasted during Ramadan under extreme conditions and even avoided eating pork to the best of their abilities. The oppressive persecution of the early Muslim American communities is further evidenced by the various writings and statements of settlers. In a statement by a French missionary, he commented in 1658 that Mohammedan slaves were stupid, materialistic, and gross in mind, that it's an unbearable pain to instruct or convert them. What was often described as the defiance of Muslim slaves to retain their own identity, living a life of bondage, it was often interpreted by the colonizers as hostility and as an unwillingness or an outright rejection of and lack of appreciation for Christian values. I'm going to skip a little bit. What I'll do is there's another quote, and this is an important quote. This is a slaveholder who I guess this quote is very telling in terms of how it perceives the Muslim slave. The native African is so vengeful and unforgiving in their tempers, easily provoked and cruel in their designs. They place little value on fine houses and superb furniture of their masters. They feel indignant at the servitude that is imposed upon them, and they only want power to inflict the most cruel retribution on their oppressors. I'm going to skip a little bit because I've got 5 minutes left, and I'm going to tie this now back to the more present day. So after slavery was abolished in 1865, many newly freed African Americans were still very much aware of their ancestral origins. For this reason, it's no coincidence that in the early 1900s, it saw the rise of organizations of African Americans under an Islamic banner. The Moorish Science Temple of America, led by Noble Drew Ully, was founded in 1913 and was the subject of immediate critique. And by 1940, it became known that the FBI had been investigating the Moorish Science Temple as well as its members for their subversive activities. And along those lines, the Nation of Islam, founded by Wallace Muhammad, who was deeply inspired by the teachings of Noble Drew Ully, and the organization of the Moorish Science Temple, was founded in 1930. Some of the most infamous and recognizable names of African-American Muslims, such as Elijah Muhammad and speaker and devotee Malcolm X, were labeled by the FBI and by the Department of Justice in 1953 as a serious threat to national security. By the 1960s, the FBI had completely infiltrated the Nation of Islam into its counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO. which was a surveillance project conducted by the FBI aimed at surveilling, infiltrating, discrediting, and disrupting political organization deemed subversive. But it was also best known for its far reaches into African-American civil rights groups, particularly black nationalist groups, such as the Nation of Islam. So. Mike Wallace's words from the opening scenes of the CBS documentary, The Hate That Hate Produced, in which he describes the Nation of Islam, is also really telling, and I'm going to read it out loud to you. These homegrown Negro American Muslims are the most powerful of the black supremacist groups. They now claim a membership of almost a quarter of a million Negroes. Their doctrine is being taught in 50 cities across the nation. Let no one underestimate the Muslims. They have their own parochial schools like this one in Chicago, where Muslim children are taught to hate the white man. Even the clothes that they wear are in sharp contrast to American dress. Like these two Negro children going to school, they show an image of two black girls in white headscarves. Wherever they go, Muslims withdraw from the life of the community. So why does all this history matter? At the same time that the phones of Malcolm X and other prominent members of the and figures of the Nation of Islam and other prominent black leaders in the country were being tapped, there was a massive migration to the United States from folks from the Middle East and South Asia, like my own parents, many of whom were Muslim, arriving to the shores of the United States seeking opportunity. America had long before these immigrants arrived from the Middle East and South Asia, America had long before made up its mind about Islam and Muslims. And to quote Sylvia Chan Mullick from the Department of American Studies at Rutgers University, contemporary U.S.-based Islamophobia can be directly traced to state and media discourses of anti-blackness directed at the Nation of Islam and black nationalist movements. And that means by the time I was a little girl, and I had this experience with my friend's father, it's no surprise that I was actually getting these deeply hostile comments because, as I said, the country, the nation, had long made up its mind about Islam and Muslims before my parents arrived. So by the time the attacks on September 11th took place in 2001, the gaping mistrust between the Christian West and the Muslim world was pretty much solidified. As Samuel Huntington's work, The Clash of Civilizations, demonstrates, as his book demonstrates. The premise of his book being that in the post-Cold War world, religion would become the new frontier for human conflict. In more recent years, the targets of anti-Muslim sentiment has been brought in to include immigrants and first-generation American Muslims. What I'll do is actually just, let me take you through this graph. So I think what's important to note in this graph, so this is a graph that displays anti-Muslim hate crime in the U.S., and it's really important to note that even prior to 9/11, which would be these bars here, there was absolutely a prevalence of Islamophobia in this country long before 9/11. And this graph, which is a graph that I made, this timeline is really meant to just emphasize the point that the Islamophobia was long in existence before. My little story right here, I've got that. That's where my friend's dad had some words with me. So this has a long history, so I just was thrown into it when my parents decided to come here in 1969 and had me in, I won't say the year I was born. So I'm just going to conclude really quickly, and I won't go into too much detail, as I think the next speaker is going to be talking about Islamophobia in the post-9/11 world. I'd like to conclude my presentation by saying that the arms of surveillance that rolled out on Muslim communities in the early mid-20th century have not only remained, but they've expanded. By tapping phones and sending informants to infiltrate into Muslim spaces and communities, both practices which were widely used by the federal government to surveil Muslim communities throughout the early and mid-1900s. Before the influx of Muslim immigrants to the U.S. in the mid to late 1900s, Muslim communities have long been spied upon, delegitimized, and turned alien, and fabricated into problem communities, for that matter. Today, federal programs continue to show us that fear and suspicion of Muslim Americans is still very much alive and ticking in the same way as it was in our origins. Thank you very much.
That was Aisha Kazmi speaking on the origins of American Islamophobia at the Forum on Islamophobia, Immigration, and DACA at Harvard Law School on December 5th. She was the first of five speakers. We hope to bring you the remaining four.